So Hawking, Stephen Hawking has this, has made scientific contributions, most of which are fairly specialist. They're fairly narrow elements of cosmology and of astrophysics. He's famous for things like Hawking radiation and this idea that black holes can radiate energy and evaporate away. And he's also done work on cosmology and brain theory and all sorts of things like that. Do you think you could describe some of the work that Stephen Hawking's done over the years? Maybe we could start off with Hawking radiation, that he's obviously named after him and is therefore probably most famous scientifically for. What's Hawking radiation?
So, Hawking radiation was I think Hawking's second big breakthrough in physics, and it came about in the early 70s, and was sort of largely propagated by another physicist called Bekenstein, Jacob Bekenstein, who died a few years ago. So this was a controversy about black holes that was around in the early 70s, and they were working, as often happens, as when people don't really know what they're doing, there's a bit of conflict between different sides, and people make claims and people make counterclaims. It seems a very paradoxical thing if you just talk about it, because one thing we know or think we know about black holes is that by very definition of them, light can't escape from a black hole. They're surrounded by what's called a horizon, and if you try and shine a torch out of a black hole, the light gets curved round and it can't escape. So that seems to be the end of the story, basically. How can the black hole radiate? You know, light can't get out of it. So I think what's really important about this work on Hawking radiation was that work on black holes, the idea that we have about black holes is basically totally classical concept. It's to do with classical general relativity. And what I mean by that is that there's no attempt in the normal description of a black hole to put any quantum theory in it, none of the quantum behavior of matter in it. We just think of space-time as a completely smooth thing and matter as being completely smooth, and all the theorems assume very simplified things about matter. So what was important about Hawking radiation was that Hawking, it was not just the thing itself, the phenomenon of Hawking radiation, but it's part of a process of trying to understand how you might put a very strong gravitational field, like around a black hole, together with a quantum theory of matter. Right. So an attempt not to do a quantum theory of gravity, which we still don't know how to do, but how to put some aspects of quantum behavior together with general relativity.
It was the first time those two had sort of been linked in that way, quantum mechanics and general relativity being the two big theories of the early 20th
yes.
century.
So it's a theme that recurs throughout the whole history of physics in the 20th century. Early general relativity came around in 1915. Einstein published the theory. Quantum mechanics was in its infancy then as well, in the great work, and that was done in the 20s. By people like Schrödinger and Heisenberg and whatever. But they basically evolved separately. There's no way that anyone had found of putting those two things together consistently, and there still isn't fully. But Hawking was exercised by the problem of what happens if you look at a quantum behavior of matter around the edge of a black hole, around the horizon of a black hole. And the approach he used is often called a semi-classical approach, not full quantum gravity, but it's quantum field theory in a curved space-time. So you let gravity, classical general relativity, curve space in the way that it's quite familiar now, that's how gravity arises from general relativity. And then on the background of a curved space, you put a quantum field theory.
Right.
That's actually quite hard to do, but it's not a full quantum theory of gravity because it doesn't quantize gravity. The space-time is still classical, but you put the quantum field on top of it. And what he found was quite extraordinary, which is that actually you take into account all the fluctuations in the fields and the creation and annihilation of particles. The presence of the horizon means that actually there's some energy that's not accounted for. And it was a lot of controversy about what where that energy goes, energy, how can it go away, and so on. And after much to-ing and fro-ing and disputes and so on, it was generally established, and Hawking proved this formula, that actually what it means is that if you have matter, the region around a black hole is radiating. And that's because even empty space in quantum field theory has fluctuations in it, which you can think of as particles coming into existence and out of existence on a very short time, virtual particles. And these particles, if you like to put it this way, some of them fall into the black hole and other ones escape.
Yeah.
And it's the ones that escape that produce the Hawking radiation. Nobody's observed this, of course. It only actually is a significant thing for very, very tiny black holes. The Hawking radiation makes the horizon of a black hole sort of glow. It radiates with a certain temperature, like a star. But if you made a black hole of the same mass as the sun, the Hawking temperature of the horizon of that black hole would be 100 nanokelvin.
Right, so that's
one ten millionth of a kelvin. So it's really a large black hole. The Hawking radiation is absolutely irrelevant to all the other stuff that would be going on. Stuff would be falling in, and you know, all kinds of other stuff would might be colliding, producing gravitational waves. You know, so it's really only for very small black holes that it makes any difference.
And by small black holes, we're talking subatomic mass,
microscopic black holes. So the thing about that is that the Hawking temperature, that is effectively, you know, how bright it is when it's radiating, is just inversely proportional to the mass of the black hole. So for really tiny masses, it's large. And the interesting thing about a black hole is that as it radiates, its mass decreases because energy is flowing out of the black hole. And so as the mass goes down, because it's inversely proportional to the temperature goes up.
So it gets faster.
It basically accelerates how quickly it's, how hot it is and how quickly it radiates. So the upshot of all this is that black holes don't just fritter away. They actually evaporate completely and actually explode in the end. When the mass goes to zero, the temperature goes infinitely large. So the upshot of all this is that if it were possible to make tiny black holes, they actually live for a very short time and end up blowing up. And we don't see a huge amount of evidence for black holes exploding around in this room. So this puts kind of limits on how many black holes of these low masses there could be. Now, apart from the fact that they evaporate according to Hawking radiation, A tiny black hole will just be like a tiny massive particle. If it didn't do that, they wouldn't know anything about it. It would just, I mean, people are scared of black holes because of science fiction movies and things. But a tiny black hole with just, all it has is a tiny amount of mass, and it doesn't do anything else.
There were all these scare stories when the Large Hadron Collider turned on that it was going to create black holes. And a lot of the scientists involved understand were going, so what?
They might be creating black holes in the Large Hadron Collider. All you would see is some energy, some mass would end up in an object which essentially doesn't interact with anything else until it evaporates. And that might be happening, and it wouldn't mean the end of the world or even the end of CERN or anything like that. It's just it's a possible phenomenon. There's no direct evidence that actually happens. And in any case, the Large Hadron Collider, there are collisions with cosmic rays in our atmosphere which are far higher energies than the Large Hadron Collider can generate, and so these things would have been going through if these particles could be created, they would have been created for the entire history of life on Earth and never harmed anyone in that period. That was a load of nonsense, really, that story. But black holes, it's actually one of those, it's like a trigger phrase, isn't it? People are scared of black holes because they think, oh, it's dangerous. Actually, it's just a small one is not dangerous at all. But it is dangerous if it evaporates because it produces radiation, you know, and would be very energetic gamma ray type radiation, which would
could be dangerous.
Could be dangerous. So the interesting thing about the Hawking radiation is that at the end of some beautiful paper, there's a beautiful paper about this in Communications in Mathematical Physics, very long and dense calculation, but very beautiful. But at the end of it, there comes a formula, a single formula, which is usually quoted as the to do with the entropy of a black hole, but it's basically temperature and things of a black hole. And it's a wonderful formula because it includes, for the first time, really, the constants of nature, which are to do with quantum mechanics, Planck's constant, relativity, the speed of light, gravitation, gravitational constant, and Boltzmann's constant,
which is
the thermodynamics. And all, you know, pages and pages of very complicated differential geometry and field theory, and then there's a wonderful, very simple equation at the end that tells you what the temperature of a black hole is. And I think that's a classic. If they want to put anything on Hawking's tombstone, I think it should be that, like they did with Boltzmann, with his Boltzmann formula for thermodynamics, K log W or whatever it is that they put on. Yeah. So that formula is very... And everyone looking back on that sees that as a classic thing. It's a great work. And if it all he'd done in his life was that work on Hawking evaporator, he'd still be a very famous scientist. But of course he did other things as well. I think that is particularly important because of this sort of... You can see it in the context of a quest to somehow put together quantum mechanics with general relativity, and that's what he was doing for much of his life.
And is it fair to say that's the closest we've ever got to doing that so far, that no one's really got...
Yeah, I mean, that was the, you know, the spectacular first step in that. I think, you know, people have worked in other directions with it now and tried to include different kind of ways of doing quantum gravity. As I say, it's not really quantum gravity. It's quantum field theory in the presence of a gravitational field, which is the gravitational field is still not a quantum field. So it's a halfway house.
Which is, I guess, is it fair to say that that's almost where general relativity itself came from? Because Einstein thinking about general relativity, this is a digression now, of course, but Einstein thinking about general relativity was trying to figure out what happened to special relativity in the presence of a gravitational field, and
so Einstein spent after 1915 and the papers on general relativity they did immediately following that, he spent most of his life trying to come up with a unified field theory that included gravitation and the other forces of nature, and he failed. He tried a different approach to what many people were doing, but it didn't get anywhere. So he actually but in a sense Hawking was trying to do a similar thing. He approached it in a very different way from what Einstein did. Einstein always knew that general relativity was limited, and he did write in 1950. I remember the words that he used in 1950 was that he said explicitly that general relativity basically treats matter in a different way from the gravitational field. Matter moves around and it determines the gravitational field, but it's not... It moves around in a background provided by gravity, and they're not equal participants. And he thought that theory had to be replaced by something more fundamental, that was a field theory that put everything on the same footing.
Right.
A gravitational field, electromagnetic fields... all the other fields in particle physics had to be tackled the same way. It's not really having gravity on one side of the equations and everything else on the other didn't look right as a fundamental theory. And he knew that it only worked for weak fields. So gravity is weak most of the time, but around a black hole or at the beginning of the universe in the Big Bang, you need a more complete description. And it's clear that we don't have that. We still don't have it, really.
Now, you mentioned that Hawking radiation was Stephen Hawking's second big breakthrough. What would you say was his first big contribution to science, or first major contribution?
Well, his first spectacular was actually in his thesis. And I think it was a bit of an accident that it happened. So in the early 60s, Roger Penrose... another brilliant mathematician and physicist, had been working on the collapse of black holes. He was trying to prove or disprove whether when at the end point of a star's life, when its ability to support itself by burning fuel is exhausted, whether it necessarily collapsed to a singularity, right, you know, a point of essentially infinite density. Now, since the early days of general relativity, people had believed that that was true. And it's definitely true that if you take a completely spherical star and switch off its life support, as it were, it collapses to a point. And that point in general relativity, there's nothing to stop it. At the center, the density goes to infinity. Mm-hmm. Now, most of the time in physics, when you get infinity, it means it's done something wrong. And people thought, generally speaking, in the 30s and 40s, that spherical collapse is really artificial. It's nothing's exactly spherical. You only get an infinity because everything arrives at the center at exactly the same time, because it's exactly spherical. Surely it would distort a little bit and you don't get
splurt out the side or whatever.
Distort or something. But Penrose actually had a totally different way of doing general relativity calculations. He had a method that was very geometrical, less to do with manipulating algebraic symbols and complicated mathematics, and more to do with a very sort of, if you like, visual way of thinking about surfaces and bundles and things like that. Differential geometry is the field that he used. And he used that to show that actually it's not to do with the spherical symmetry. It's actually inevitable, whatever's going on, gravitational collapse under these circumstances produces a singularity somewhere. And that was a beautiful result. So Hawking found out about this, and he thought, well, actually, this, I really like this mathematical approach. It's beautiful. What if I try and apply this not to the collapse of a black hole, but to the expansion of the universe after the Big Bang?
So turn it around.
To make do it backwards. Yeah. Can we apply this technique? It sounds trivial, but it's not. There are a number of complications in doing that. But what he did, together with Penrose, because they worked collaboratively, got in touch and worked collaboratively on this, that actually the same thing is true of the Big Bang. So if you take if you run the clock backwards from our expanding universe and go back into the past, the early work on cosmology in the 1920s by Friedman and Lemaître and people like that suggested that there had to be a singularity, point of infinite density at the beginning. There was a similar suspicion that this was just artificial because it made lots of assumptions about how smooth the universe was and so on. But the Hawking-Penrose theorems showed that this actually was not exceptional. And in fact, it was an inevitable consequence that you have what's called a trapped surface, which essentially means that there's something where a horizon, it's like the formation of a black hole. And I think that was the last chapter of Hawking's PhD thesis. And I think that was what made him initially famous. And people realized that he really was an incredible talent. It makes it sound a lot easier when you say, oh, it was Penrose's stuff. And, you know, I took Penrose's idea and turned it around and just put a minus sign in somewhere. Mm. There's a lot more to it than that, but I think it took a lot of vision to realise how to go about this problem.